Live Line on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry, bringing you great savings on curtains and bedding. Available all year in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Live Line. Colm O'Mungain here. You can get us from the north on 08457 85333. Send us your WhatsApp voice notes on 087 484 888. 51551 for your text. Joe at rt.ie for your emails. Michelle Mannion, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm. How are you?
How's your day going so far today?
My day is very long, Colm. That's how my day is today. You know, I'm on the go since a little after 1 o'clock this morning, so I'm almost ready for bed, really.
All right. Maybe we'll give them the reason behind it in a minute, but just give us a flavour of how your day begins, where you have to go, and who's on this journey with you.
Sure. So we have two gorgeous young sons, Connor and Dara. They're 16 and 14. They're both autistic and non-verbal. They would have an intellectual disability, and they have very acute sensory challenges. They're two very high support young men. So Connor, our oldest guy, he pretty much only sleeps approximately 4 to 5 hours in any 24 hours. So ordinarily he'd fall asleep around 10, but he's pretty much up then by 1 or 2 o'clock. And myself or his dad, Garode, we alternated every second night. One of us will get up with him. He will invariably wake his younger brother, Dara, who's 14. And then we're all up then from pretty much 2 o'clock on. The boys attend a special school in Galway called Obatha Special School. And they deal with a profile of children like Connor and Dara, very complex, very high support needs. And I don't regret a single day that I have driven the boys to Obatha. This is where they need to be to get the education and support that
and
they need.
You might say, Michelle, where you're driving them. So Albalda is in Parkmore on the outskirts of Galway City. You're driving them there from where?
I live in Spansel Hill outside Ennis. So we do approximately, you know, it's a 2 hour round trip twice a day, 140 kilometres twice a day. So it comes in somewhere around 1100 kilometres a week, 20 hours driving a week, to get the boys to and from school each day.
Now, there's a particular challenge with bringing both lads at the same time. Maybe you'd explain why to the listeners.
Yeah. So it's quite sad. The boys really can't coexist happily together because of their different types of sensory challenges. So my youngest son, he experiences sound as a pain. So a sudden sound like a car door banging, somebody sneezing, a child yelping, Dara will experience that as though you've put a dagger in his heart, and he will cry, and then this will start self-injury behaviours. We would never, ever put Connor and Dara in a car together to go anywhere. You know, one will be with Dad in his car, one will be with me in my car. But when we put them both in the car to go to school, what happens is Connor, my eldest, he vocalizes, he has these very loud shrieks, which he repeats over and over again. My younger son, Dara, who is averse to sound, will start a meltdown. That meltdown makes Connor's shrieks louder. The louder shrieks makes Dara's meltdown more violent, and it's self-injury. And so the car becomes this hurricane of sound and movement. I mean, I take off my glasses, my earrings, anything that the boys could pull at. And I just have to focus on keep driving forwards, just keep moving forwards, because it won't stop until I can separate the lads. Now, right. The amazing staff at all of that, they know, they're standing outside to meet us when we arrive, like a comet on fire, and they will separate the kids and help them to de-escalate when they arrive.
I know, but sure, the poor fellas, they're arriving at school. I mean, anyone who's dropped off, you know, maybe somebody to junior infants this year who's having trouble adjusting to school, you know, calming down a child in 10 minutes of crying is one thing. But for fellas who've been highly distressed on a 70-kilometre journey all the way to school, I mean, what's that? It's about, it's the guts of an hour of a journey. How long does it take to reassure them and calm them down and try and de-escalate? Yeah.
Listening to the staff, it varies, you know, it varies on how difficult the journey has been. You know, there are days where, you know, one of the boys may arrive with a really profuse nosebleed, or they both tend to rip their clothes when they're in the midst of a big meltdown. So it depends when we arrive how distressed they are, but approximately 30 to 40 minutes, that's the time that's taken out of their day where they have a chance at an education, where they're trying to come down and be calm, when really they should be arriving at school. They love school. School is the centre of their world. It's where everything happens for them. They don't have friends. You know, they're not like typical kids. Everything, their birthday parties, all their important things for us as a family happen through their school. And during COVID, for example, Dara, who's nonverbal, would bring me his Obelta jumper as his way of saying, like, Mom, you know, please bring me to school. Now, I have no way of explaining that in a similar way. I have no way of explaining why suddenly the bus stopped, which they both really enjoyed. And they would arrive at school completely calm and happy and hop off the bus and go in and start their day like the rest of the kids.
And before we get into the situation with the bus, Michelle, I mean, when you're trying to drive a car, there's effectively three of you that arrive out of that car on the steps of the school traumatised.
That's, you know, it's not a word I like to throw around, but I sometimes say it's like the feeling after a car accident, you know, where your body is just shaking from the kind of relentlessness of the sound and movement. You know, I'm afraid for them and I'm afraid for myself, because on a bus, we had four children on our bus, my two boys and two other gorgeous little fellas that were, well, they're men now, that would be collected on the way. And they would have a driver whose sole job is to just drive and keep everybody safe. They would have two bus escorts who were also wonderful women and with us for a long time. And they would go and come between the boys, keep everybody calm, give them what they needed. And in that way, the whole journey for everybody was so much safer and so much calmer. It's just, you know, shoehorning them into a car, it's like an echo chamber, and it's a disaster for both boys.
Right. And are they reluctant to get into the car as a result?
They are. My older son, Connor, he's a real softie and he's very good. You know, he'll hop into the car. But Dara is already starting to build up as he walks towards the car. He'll have his fingers in his ears. He'll be kicking his feet. You know, he stubs his toes very badly on the ground. So he'll start by doing that. And it's as though Dara uses that pain to offset the pain of Connor's noise on the way up to Galway, you know.
And what was so good about the bus, Michelle? You mentioned the driver had his job to do. He got them from A to B. And then you had people who were assistants on the bus who kept the lads ticking over on the bus. But how are the buses able to manage the different sensory needs of everybody on the bus? And what kind of a difference did it make for you waving them off on the bus to school every day?
It was immeasurable. I mean, I don't want to overplay the impact the bus had on us, but for families who have kids with additional needs out there, they know that every single pillar of support that you can hold on to, it's so invaluable. So the bus would come at 8:30 in the morning. The boys love it. It's a different experience completely to the car in terms of the height. You know, they have such a good line of sight. And what they would do was put Dara sitting in the very front seat of the bus. It was actually a very large bus for four children, but it is because of their complex profiles. And they'd sit the kids almost like in a triangular fashion all the way to the back of the bus until Connor would sit at the very back seat. So the distance between the two boys, and you see Dara could wear his ear defenders. It's pointless in him wearing ear defenders here in the car because Connor is right beside him. You know, he can't avoid the visuals of the sound almost will sure. also set him off. So on the bus, he has his ear defenders. He'll watch music on YouTube, look out the front window and be perfectly happy and calm to go to Galway that way. Right. And Connor's anxiety drops off then. He sits at the back of the bus and he's like, great, I can't hear Dara either. I'll just be calm and watch my little YouTube videos. And as a result, they both arrive then happy men, ready to learn at school.
And the, I suppose when the bus pulls off, and bearing in mind at this stage you've been up since 2 or 3 in the morning, do yourself and Garode get to go back and grab a couple of hours sleep and prep yourself for when the lads come back and to greet them off the bus and you know, to go through the rest of the day?
Sure. Well, we both work, so it's not having the bus now is an absolute nightmare, because invariably we're looking at each other saying, I need to go in this morning, or I have a call this morning. You know, we're constantly juggling that. Now, I went from 5 days to 4 days to 2 days, which is where I am now. And I'm looking at having to give up my job, which I enjoy. I just enjoy the break. I enjoy seeing the girls at work. I enjoy, it's just a break from autism world. And in an ideal world, I'd like to hang on to my 2 days. But I don't think I can. It's the sleep, the lack of sleep. Is, you just cannot cheat sleep.
All right.
You need to sleep. So, you know, that's what we need to do. Go back to bed after the boys.
And how long have you been without the bus, Michelle?
This is our 3rd year now without the bus.
Right.
So really the whole family has,
I mean, you talk about the bus like it's yesterday. I mean, the difference the bus made sounds a very vivid thing to you.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, it also in terms of for the lads, it's a skill. So I know this may sound unusual to parents of typical kids, but for the lads to learn to get on a bus, to sit for that time, to feel calm, to be familiar with the bus if they're going to use it as they get older, that is a skill in itself. You know, instead of just being ferried by myself from A to B. Also, when the bus would pull out in the morning, you would feel your shoulders go from your ears down. You know, you would just exhale the bus out the front gate, and you know, it would give me a chance just to have a shower, have a cup of tea, you know, get over what is invariably that time between 2 a.m. and 8 is very difficult with the two boys, because I can't separate them in the way I would normally, because it's dark outside.
Right.
So I can't put one boy in the car. I can't put one boy in the car and go for a drive with him to keep them apart. I need to keep them both in the house because it's dark.
And I mean, you say you've gone from 4 days a week down to 2 days a week. So your income is effectively halved. You're driving 1,100 kilometres of round trips from Spancil Hill to Parkmore in Galway. That's a hell of a lot of fuel to be burning on the road as well. And, you know, I think EOS, if anecdotal evidence and ESRI studies have showed that so many people whose children have a disability are put to huge added extra expense just in terms of day-to-day living as well. So, I mean, it's a massive financial hit to you as well.
It is. Look, the hidden expenses of having kids with special needs is huge. And, you know, the requirement for you invariably to have to give up your job to care for the lads is right, but almost unmanageable. You know, my two would break a lot of furniture. And that is not through malice. That is through while they're having a meltdown, while they are completely distressed. And because they are men now, you know, they are both, as I said, Connor is 16, he's 6 foot, he's 15 stone. You know, he's a big rugby player type build. And all of that adds to your daily stress. So we're constantly replacing beds, replacing mattresses, replacing the couch. And that on top of the fuel cost is absolutely huge. It's like a second mortgage. So all of those things add up, not just from a financial perspective, but from a hugely stressful perspective. It's just another rung on the ladder that you're worried about. And I mean, I need to be around forever. I mean, I need to be around for the boys forever. And I just think it is so difficult. I'm mortified, frankly, to be on this show highlighting this. And when I reflected on that, I thought, no, the shame lies with the state and the providers that they've charged with supporting families like mine. They know what needs to be done. When the government announced that additional bus places would be made available, they clearly gave no thought to the bus errand capacity issue with drivers, or they didn't engage with them appropriately to find out. We had a bus driver. He turned 70, a wonderful bus driver. And once he turned 70, he could no longer work for Bus Éireann. They have a policy in place.
They do, and they say in line with safety reasons, they say the retirement age for school bus drivers has been set by Bus Éireann at 70 years of age, which also applies to road passenger service, and they say it's grounded, that policy is grounded in the best safe interests of the customers. Now, we did contact them about your case as well. They said the contractor in your case ceased trading, but it also says, dear parent, I think they've been in touch with her, with you, excuse me, is it to say they do have a contractor sourced and they think they're completing safety checks and that they're going to try to have a solution ready as soon as possible. Are you reassured by that at all?
I am in no way reassured by that.
Why not?
My family and the other two families who are on this bus route, we have had many a false dawn with our bus route. So this isn't the first time we've heard that type of information. I mean, in previous years, I would have been very excited and thought, oh my goodness, this is it. We're getting our bus back. And for whatever reason, at the ninth hour, it falls apart. So until I see a bus idling in my driveway, I have no faith whatsoever that the service will be delivered. It's literally not worth the paper it's written on until the bus is in the driveway.
And how many times over the last 3 years when you've been without this bus have you had information like that from Bus Éireann to say, look, a solution is imminent?
To be honest, I'm not 100% sure. Maybe three or four. Not a lot of times because it has been so difficult to source a bus, but, you know, perhaps three or four times in the last 3 years. You know, we were very close at one stage just recently where we thought that's it, we're absolutely sorted. And we even spoke about hiring bus escorts and then that didn't come to fruition. So, yes, I completely acknowledge Bus Éireann wrote to us last week to say this, but I'm not hopeful. I'm hopeful, but I'm not confident.
Sure. Okay. Well, they've apologised and they say they're working to get a solution. So hopefully this time round it will come to fruition. And I suppose for the moment and until you advise otherwise, we'll just have to take that statement on good faith. But Michelle, thanks very much for sharing that with us. I'm sure it probably resonates with people in the same situation with you. And I know it's not easy to come on and talk about it. As you say, they're two great fellas. You know, you don't want
Thank
to be
you.
Coming on and presenting it as if they're a problem. You live with them, you love them, and despite the challenges that you're talking about, they're two fellas who are your sons and the loves of your life, and you're not putting it forward
Absolutely.
In any other way.
Thank you, Colm. And finally, I would just like to call on our government representative to engage with Bus Éireann to seek a resolution around the possibility of workers above the age of 70 working with them, perhaps an annual medical or if there was some way around this. But there's many suitable, wonderful people over the age of 70 who would like to be working and would very much enjoy this type of position. It seems arbitrary that a bus driver can't drive them to school but can then arrive at school at 9:30 and collect them as a private provider and bring them on their school tour or whatever it might be. So I call on them to try and implement some change to facilitate additional drivers.
Okay, Michelle Mannion, thanks very much for that. Best of luck to Conor, Dara, and indeed to your husband, Garode, as well. We're back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, at some point in your life, you've probably looked at the place where some missing object used to be and shook your head and said, why in the name of God would somebody steal that? Or seen something missing from a public place and said the same thing. Why in the name of God would somebody steal that? Fergus Sweeney, what's missing?
Hi, Colin. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, so we are missing a ship and a bottle from Blacksod Lighthouse in County Mayo.
And it's a model ship, one of those classic ship in a bottle, like an ornament. Where was it displayed in the lighthouse and when did it go missing?
Yeah, Colm, so it is displayed in Gallery 2 of Blacksod Lighthouse, and we actually utilise this ship in the bottle for our storytelling. It depicts a miniature model of Blacksod Lighthouse and a sailing boat, a yawl, a black sailing boat with red sails. And we noticed last Saturday morning when we were preparing to go on our first tour that it wasn't on the table in its usual spot. And obviously the tour had to commence, so we had to carry on. And later on that that day, then we kind of realised that it was probably went missing on the Friday afternoon, sometime between 3 and 5 o'clock in the evening.
And nothing unusual noticed? Nobody with a strange bulge in their coat at any point on the tour? Nothing, no?
No, the weather was quite good last weekend and last week, so there was quite a lot of visitors in and around the Blacksod Lighthouse area. So we would normally have one guide on duty in the lighthouse, and we would have another person working in a ticket office outside. And so we don't know how did this happen. Was it somebody who came in and did one of our tours, or possibly while a tour was underway in the lighthouse, did somebody make their way into the building, spot this, and like you said, stick it under a jacket or pop it into a bag and walk out the door? But it has our staff here quite upset, because it was something that we kind of cherished having it in our collection at the lighthouse. It was actually made by a retired lighthouse keeper, Richard Cummings, and donated to us for use on the tours as an example of what lighthouse keepers would do in their spare time, but also to help us tell the story of how families in the 1800s would have got to and from the local island lighthouses.
And what size of a bottle was it? Because for anybody who's familiar with ships in bottles, they can be either very small bottles or some of the larger kind of bottles that you might see coins stored in, you know, multiple litres with a sizable ship inside in it. So what size of a bottle was this one?
Yeah, so we're talking about a litre-sized bottle, so not the biggest bottle in the world. You know, I've certainly seen ships and bottles much larger. So in and around about the litre size, and very distinctive again, it's a one-of-a-kind. There is no other ship in a bottle like this. It's, as I said, it's got the miniature of Blacksod Lighthouse in it and the little yawl sailing boat in it. So very distinctive.
And did Richard make it while he was a lighthouse keeper, or did he make it in retirement?
He made it in retirement. The skill that he has of making these ships and bottles, and Richard makes some absolutely stunning ships and bottles, is something that he would have learned from older lighthouse keepers that he worked with in his time in Irish Lights. And now in his retirement, I guess this is something he does in his spare time.
Right. It was something, I suppose, to combat the isolation of being a lighthouse keeper, that you needed what's effectively a hobby to give you a bit of occupational therapy while you're whiling away the long, dark hours as a lighthouse keeper, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Many lighthouse keepers would have made these. My own father, who was a lighthouse keeper, he also made ships and bottles, and some other lighthouse keepers made replica ships, you know. So they had the time, they had plenty of time to get right into the detail of these things. And, you know, it truly is an art form.
Right, but I mean, its value really in Blacksod Lighthouse, its value is only really in the context of Blacksod Lighthouse. It's something that was built by a retired lighthouse keeper. It shows the lighthouse and the way people would have got back and forth to islands in the area. But taken out of Blacksod, does this have any real kind of commercial value on the black market for ships in bottles, if there is a busy black market for ships in bottles?
Well, I can't imagine there is a huge black market for them. But I mean, I guess, look, it's probably a desirable piece that somebody may like to have themselves. They certainly can go from, you know, €150 up in price, depending on the size and the detail. But I guess, again, for us, it's invaluable in what it gives to us in our storytelling and being part of our collection at Blacksod Lighthouse. So, again, I mean, obviously, we wouldn't like to think that somebody stole it to just stick it up online or something and sell it. But again, it's so distinctive, we'd hope that it would be almost impossible for anyone to try and sell on, you know.
Right. I mean, has anything else been stolen in the course of tours, and have you had to take any precautions, or will you be taking any precautions after this? But I mean, I suppose start at the top of that list of questions. Has anything been robbed before?
No, we've been quite fortunate. You know, we've been operating the tours at Blacksod Lighthouse since 2001, and we've never had an incident like this before, you know. But obviously, I think going forward now, we will have to review the situation, and be it, you know, keeping doors closed and maybe installing CCTV, which is obviously something we don't, you know, we don't like having to do. We like Blacksod Lighthouse to be kind of open and welcoming, you know. Now, anyone attending Blacksod Lighthouse for a tour must be accompanied by a guide because of the nature of the building. It still serves a purpose, not only as a lighthouse, but as a search and rescue refueling centre. So, you know, generally people going in there must be accompanied by a guide. We do have instances where people maybe walk in the door without realising that, you know. So again, you know, whether it was somebody on a tour or whether somebody just seen their opportunity to duck in the door, spotted this and kind of swiped it, you know.
Right. I mean, somebody may well be sitting there looking at a mantelpiece with Richard Cummings' picture of Richard Cummins model of a yacht in a bottle, and, you know, thinking it looks well on the mantelpiece. It'd obviously look a hell of a lot better back in Blacksod Lighthouse, where, I mean, it's not just talking about the lives of lighthouse keepers. I mean, there's also, I suppose, a historic story emanating from close to your own family from the same lighthouse, isn't there? Or from the same area, should I say. You have connections of historic proportions from Blacksod and the weather station.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it was my own grandparents, my grandfather, who was the attendant lighthouse keeper at Blacksod, and his wife Maureen, my grandmother, who would have sent the famous ground observations, weather observations that influenced the D-Day landings. So the building, Blacksod Lighthouse itself, is, you know, it's almost a second home to us as a family. And again, to have that kind of, have somebody come in and just take something because they feel they're entitled to take it, it's got a sting in it, you know.
And is that when the weather station was, in the lighthouse?
No, the weather station was actually located just up, as we call it, the Lighthouse Road, in the old Royal Navy Coast Guard station. But both my grandfather and my grandmother would have been the residents in Blacksod Lighthouse at the time. And of course, they more or less job shared in the weather station at that time in the 1940s.
All right. Fergus, how can they contact, if anyone has spots this, I mean, if it was discarded around or left in a pub afterwards or something, how would they get in touch with you in order to tell you that they have it?
So, They can reach us on the social media platforms. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and we're also on X as Blacksod Lighthouse. They can give us a call, send us a message. I have a phone number. We can give you that phone number, maybe, if anyone wants to contact you guys there, and you can pass on the number to them.
All right.
You know, at best, maybe they could, if somebody does have it and they have a change of heart, wrap it up well, stick it in a box and get it in the post back to Blacksod Lighthouse, Blacksod, County Mayo. That address will get straight to us.
Okay, I think you sent us a picture. We might stick that out on social media as well to give people a flavour of what that looks like. Now, we're going to stay with strange thefts and strange thefts in bottles as well. Niamh, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm. How are you doing?
Good. Be careful what you steal when you steal a bottle. Tell us what happened. What unusual theft happened in your own family?
Well, it's a story that happened to my mother, actually. So I'm living down here in County Waterford, but I'm originally from Clontarf in Dublin. And in 1955, my mother got the bus from Clontarf into the city centre in Dublin. And she had a Mac on with a, you know, long pocket, long loose pocket. So someone could easily steal out of the Mac. But she had a little baby powers bottle in her pocket.
For anyone who is unfamiliar with the baby power, this is one of these. It's a double measure of whiskey in a very small bottle. It's Powers used to sell them in little squat bottles with an easily openable top on it.
Yeah. Yes, and before you think my mother was a bit of a drinker, she absolutely wasn't. She was far from it. But I'd say that morning the bottle was handy for her. Because she was actually going into the Rotunda Hospital. She was pregnant with my eldest brother, Shane, and she had her sample in it.
She had her sample in it, so it wasn't a baby powers for Dutch courage as she headed towards the Rotunda. Her sample.
It was her urine sample. Yes,
in the baby powers bottle?
Yes.
How did she get it into a baby powers bottle? Is she a good aim or did she use a funnel?
I have no idea. I'd say there must have been some class of a funnel now or something, somehow, or a jug or something. I have no idea how she got it in. But anyway, that's what.
And come here, it was in the pocket of the Mac, a baby powers bottle, and somebody spotted this and reached
on the bus, so that when she got off the bus to stop at the hospital, it was no longer there.
So. Right. And the thief on the bus.
Well,
they were hoping for something that would warm the cockles of their heart.
Well,
I'd say it barely cleared the throat.
It might have cleared the throat. You wouldn't know. There might be a new remedy in it. I don't know. But so my mother now would have been, you know, in the 50s, particularly in the 50s, you know, women would have got a bit of a raw deal. And men would have been, you know, the top dogs. She'd have had to give up her job the year before because of the marriage ban, because she was working in the civil service, you know. And because when she got married, she had to give up her job. So I'd say she probably thought he deserved it. You know?
No sympathy.
You know, no sympathy. No, I'd say no sympathy at all with him.
Right. And how close, I wonder how close she was to home because, you know,
oh,
the,
no,
the bottle might have been still warm. He might have thought he was robbing a hot toddy.
Yeah, well, oh, no. Oh, God. I didn't even think of that. I don't know.
Right. Fergus, you're still on the line there. What do you make of that? Just desserts for a bottle thief.
Yeah, well, I mean, it could be one way of looking at it. Hopefully, if they took a swig out of it, they've learned a lesson.
Right. I mean, your ship in a bottle only depicted salt water on which the yacht was floating. Neve's mother's bottle had the genuine article. Plenty of salt content in the contents of that bottle.
Yeah. I don't think the person that stole that might be coming forward too quickly.
No, they may still be on the flat of their back since 1955. Barely recovered. All right, okay, be careful what you rob.
Absolutely.
Dimpna, we were talking to Billy Kelly and he was talking about his access issues with his rollator and the negotiations he has to get into with some bus drivers. Some bus drivers are very proactive in letting down their wheelchair ramp, others less so, but... access issues are something that are a concern to you as well. You're not on a rollator. You have a different challenge.
Yes, Colm, I was listening to your programme during the week and just Billy struck a note with me because I'd know quite a lot of people who use rollators and wheelchairs. And I have to say, I find no problem with the drivers on Bus Éireann or the rural buses in general. But Dublin Bus are a different breed.
Right.
I just want to get that out there. But
all right. Well, I mean, the Dublin Bus themselves say, look, they encourage all their drivers to be flexible and you know, encourage accessibility. But where did you find yourself last Saturday? And what situation did you find yourself in?
Yeah, last Saturday, Colm, I took the bus to Dublin anyway, to Palmerstown. I had an appointment up there and I took the bus, as I would often take to Dublin, but not often get off in Palmerstown. And when I was finished my appointment, it was about 5 o'clock or so. I knew I had to cross the, I should say it at the outset, I'm vision impaired. And I knew I had to cross the ramp on the road to get to the other side to get the return bus home, which I'd never done before. And I was coming down the ramp and went as far as I could with my cane in front of me. And I basically then went across the road, a small road, and found myself in what seemed to be a park.
Right,
there was no way down.
There was no indicator on the pavement when you got to the bottom of the ramp of, as they have at certain crossing points where they'd almost be like, for anybody who's seen them, though, that kind of red brick with upturned football studs on it so people with visual impairment can feel them with their canes.
Yeah. So it unsettled me a bit. But anyway, I knew I had to get on the bus. It was getting dark or it was getting late and I knew I had to get home. So I tried to walk down to the main road, but there was no footpath. And then, you know, there was heavy traffic, but I realised I was on the wrong side of the junction. I was on the Mullingar side rather than I needed to be on the Dublin side where the bus stop was.
And were there pedestrian lights, Dimpna?
No. There were pedestrian lights when I got down to the bottom of the ramp going towards the park.
Sure, but once you'd crossed over, you'd kind of gone out of range of them, had you?
I had gone into grass, basically, or into a narrow path.
You must have got an awful land when you found yourself kind of off pavements or any indicators, that you could have maybe navigated around with the cane.
Yes. Yeah. It was grass unless I went further into the park. And then I was afraid to go there because I'd get completely lost. So I started to head down towards the main N4, I suppose you call it. And I knew there was a lot of traffic and I knew it wasn't going to be safe. There was no pavement. But anyway, somebody stopped, a lady in a car rolled down the window and said, you look lost. And I said, I'm trying to find the bus stop. And she just said, I'll come back for you. And then the horn started to blow and it got me more agitated.
All right, this and the horns were blowing. Was she at this woman? She was pulling a turn, or because she'd stopped? Okay.
Yeah, and I said, "No, you're okay. I'll find it. I'll be fine," because I didn't want to cause a bigger accident or an accident. So I headed back up to the park again and was wondering, where the hell will I go now? So I was thinking of heading back to the ramp, which I know would bring me back over the Dublin side again, which wasn't much good.
And how far away, how close to were you to the time the bus was departing at this stage as you were trying to find the bus stop?
To be honest, Colm, I didn't know what time the bus was coming at. I'm used to waiting until the bus comes.
Right.
Once I got to the bus stop, I knew I'd be safe when I get the next one, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, you have some patience. You have some patience.
Well, I have no choice really in that matter. I'm very grateful to have the bus and the free bus pass. So for that, I am grateful and I greatly appreciate it. But I just couldn't find a way to get down to the bus stop or to the shelter. So anyway, out of the blue, if you could call it the blue, a lady approached me, and I presume it was the same lady in the car, but I'm not sure.
All right. So she had turned the car at this point, or done whatever she needed to do to get her way back and find yourself.
I didn't know what she had done, but I presume it was the same lady. And the only thing I can think of, I think she had blonde hair and she was about the same size as me, which is about 5'3". So she said, that turn off, she says, is very hard to find. She says, come on and I'll show you where it is.
And
so she took me by the elbow and brought me back.
And you got to the bus stop successfully. Weren't people badly off, though, when they could see her, you know, talking to somebody who obviously, you know, had the white stick, and she was talking to them that they were beeping at her, you know?
Yeah, they may not have seen that, and they were in a hurry to get through the lights while they were green, I suppose. I don't know. I just felt I didn't want to cause any more trouble, if you know.
Yeah. Right. But anyway, look, she navigated through the traffic and the hostility and found her way back to you. I know, I mean,
I came back, yeah.
You'd rather not be reliant on the help of good Samaritans like that. It would have been far handier if it had been clear at the bottom of the ramp.
Yes.
How you might have got to the bus stop.
Exactly. Or some indication. You know, I use Google Maps a lot. But there was no indication on that there was a pedestrian turn off.
All right, you use the audio function on Google Maps, is it?
Yes, I use the headphones, and then it tells me where to go and how many metres to turn right, left, or whatever.
All right, and do you find is it good? Does it do the job?
I do find it very good. Now, sometimes you might be going in the wrong direction, and you know, you look at it and you're 3 minutes away from wherever you are, and then it could be 4 minutes away, so you know you're going in the wrong direction. It just says head north or head south, and you might know which is north or south.
Oh yeah, well, I think you find yourself, visual impairment or no visual impairment, you find yourself in the same boat as many people who are trying to turn their phone in the right direction and see which way the blue arrow is pointing, and then they have to start walking to find out if they're going in the right direction, and then they turn back, and if they're with other people, there's a bit of an argument over what way they should be going. But anyway, you find the audio function is helpful once you get on the right road and go in the right direction.
Yeah, very helpful. Yeah, really helpful.
So are you looking, would you like to contact this woman, or if she recognises herself in this conversation, to get in touch, or at least to hear that you're grateful you made your bus?
Yes, I did. And I was so relieved and just so anxious about getting to the bloody bus stop that I forgot to say thanks or even ask her name or her phone number, that I could ring her and say, well, look, I got home, thanks very much. So she must, I have a feeling she must live around that area in Palmerstown. You know, it's just where you turn off for Palmerstown Village near the footbridge. I have a feeling she must live around there, because she was very aware of what was going on and where I was and how to get back to me without obviously going back up the motorway. If it was the same lady, she must have took a left turn someplace and came back.
And if you were going back to Palmerstown, do you think you'd be confident to find in the bus stop at this stage? Do you think you'd have figured it out, or would you still be a bit nervous about
No.
I'd be
confident, because once I'd been someplace once, you know, you have confidence in where to go the next time. The only thing was that when I went up the first time, my friend brought me. At the second time I went up, I continued on to Dublin and then got my usual stop home. But this was the first time I'd used the footbridge.
All right. Well, look, Dimna, you're very good to ring in, and I hope the person who helped you at least can hear it. But anyway, I'm sure she didn't do it for the thanks. It sounds like she did it out of the goodness of her heart, and it was in her nature anyway. But thanks anyway for calling in and expressing your appreciation. We're just going to take a quick break, but before we do, news is coming in that the veteran actor Maggie Smith, who people know from Downton Abbey, has passed away. So that's sad news just in there. We'll take a break. Back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungain here. Late August, given heavy rain and sun, for a full week the blackberries would ripen. At first just one, a glossy purple clot, among others red, green, hard as a knot. You ate that one first, its flesh was sweet, like thickened wine, summer's blood was in it. Blackberry picking by Seamus Heaney. Aging you here, Nick. Dismurgwich.
Dismurgwichane.
Blackberry picking, it's coming near the end of the time of year for it. Although there are some big ones out on the bushes, we're not clear of it, I suppose, till Halloween. But would you encourage people to get out with their punnets, plastic bags, or whatever they have with them, and get picking?
Absolutely, and you know what, my hands, although it's the best fun you can have this time of year, it should really come with a health warning. I live in Inishmeon, and we were just out with the students of Colostan Avon in the secondary school here, blackberry picking for a couple of hours this morning in preparation for our Inishmeon Blackberry Festival tomorrow. So we know all about it here and where are the best spots, and the best thing you want to pick them in, put them in, is usually like a bucket and one with a lid, because, oh my God, the worst thing in the world, of course, is going to bother picking all your blackberries and then having them fall all over the ground if there's an accident. So there's just such fun in it. And of course, so many different things we can use the blackberry for. If you're living somewhere like this in a rural area, or even urban areas, I suppose, have blackberries everywhere and anywhere. You can do so much. It's not just jams, it's gins, it's ink making if you want it. You could do tie-dyeing if you want it. There's just, once you start looking into the different ways you can use your blackberries, there's no end to it, really.
All right. Gin and ink. Start with gin there first. What's the how do you put them into existing gin, or are you distilling it from scratch?
That's it. Well, I suppose in Inishmeon they have an interesting tradition with kind of like gin. Well, not so much gin. They used to call it slow or blackberry wine, and the idea that was just a bit of fun for kids. They would get glass bottles and put the puichery, we call them here, instead of smeradova or blackberries, into a glass bottle with some water and bury it under the ground for a little while. And that was considered to be a delicacy for the kids, more of a game than anything. But then for the grown-ups these days, of course, it's very popular to make things like slow gin. But blackberry gin is just as tasty, if not tastier, and so easy to make. So like you say, you just use gin, the cheapest stuff now you can get. I mean, don't be wasting your money on the posh stuff. Just get really cheap gin. And then collect your lovely blackberries. You put them in a big sort of glass jar, whatever you have to hand, something like a Kilner jar or whatever, an unbranded one. And then you just put in a little bit of sugar, put it in a dark place. And if you're making it this time of year, it's absolutely perfect, because it makes an excellent Christmas present come December.
All right. And I suppose, does it matter if you're making jam out of the blackberries, if they're not at full ripeness? Because you're probably going to be lashing a load of sugar into jam anyway.
Well, that's it. And similarly with baking, I mean, the whole of Inishmeon is flat out at the moment, because we have a big baking competition tomorrow for our Blackberry Festival sale in Abuichaghy. But like that, when you're adding so much sugar into something, it doesn't matter too much if they're a little bit tart. Sometimes that actually improves the flavour of your jam, because you don't want your blackberry to be too ripe or oversweet. That might take away some of the flavour than if you're using it for jams or for baked goods. But really, it's still going to be delicious, whatever way. It's really hard to mess up a good jam or a good bake once you have your blackberries in plenty.
Right. And the puichery rather than smeradova, is that particularly an Inishmeon thing? Is it a Connemara thing, or is it more widespread than that?
Well, now, if there's people on the other islands listening in, they might be calling with their complaints, but I'm going to put my hand out there and say it's an Inishmeon thing. I never heard it anywhere else anyways. I moved to Inishmeon from Wexford, and it was one of the first words I learned that was a unique Inishmeon word, puichery. So Irish speakers would know puichach as like mud, is another word for mud in Irish, is puichach, but really doesn't mean mud. You know, it means like a squishy, smoshy type thing, which of course is a blackberry, a squashy
right.
thing.
So like blobs.
Just like mud, just like the blackberries.
That's a kind of a word for blobs, is it?
Little squashy things. That's the puichuchai. So that's why we took it, because it was such an unusual word, a local word, to celebrate the heritage of Inis Mion as well as the amazing blackberries that are all over the island. We decided to name the festival after that. So it's becoming a very popular word.
And you're a Wexford woman. I mean, we won't start fights with North County Dublin on this, but arguably the home of juicy berries. You see them all over the country come the end of the summer season, Wexford strawberries and other soft fruits. So how would you rank the Inis Mion blackberry by comparison to the berries of Wexford?
Well, they're totally different things now. The Wexford strawberry is in, it's in a total field of its own, pardon the pun. But the thing about Inis Mion, which gives the blackberries perhaps an upper hand, is that, I'm not sure if you know this, but the Aran Islands have a microclimate. And that microclimate has all to do with the karst landscape of the Burn and the Aran Islands. Because, especially Inis Mion, I'm not sure if you know, it's known as the Rocky Island or Antillon Craga, where they actually supposedly got the name for Craggy Island, was inspired by here. Because we have so much exposed rock, that works like a storage heater, soaking up all the heat through the summer and then very slowly releasing it through the year. And then, of course, all the berries here that grow on the ground are soaking up that heat too. And that releases nice temperatures. There's very little fluctuation, which produces a really tasty berry. Much tastier now than any blackberry you'd get somewhere else.
We have all right. Well, I don't know. We have John Arnold on the other line from around Fermoy. What would you say to that, John? How are the blackberries around your region? Do you think they'd give na Puichuchí of Inis Mion a run for their money?
I don't know, I never heard that word before, but it's a good year for them around here anyway. But I suppose this time of year you have us coming, bringing back memories of 50 or 60 years ago. Possibly we'd be talking about jam and jelly and that. We used to look at them as a great source of income back in the 60s and 70s. We used to get half a crown for a stone of them, that was £14, and then it went up to 5 shillings for a stone. I'm talking about the years now in the mid-60s. There's a company called Cars and Corregresto and their bother in Cock and Wall for their spoil. I don't know what they were spoiling for. I don't think it's for jam making or wine making. I'm not sure, was it for dye or something, but that we just make it out of pocket money from that time, you know.
And how many would you have to pick? I mean, how long would you be picking before you'd get a stone's worth of blackberries to get 5 shillings?
It was a good afternoon, but even then the crop on like this year, you know, for instance, was absolutely brilliant. They were just literally like grapes and a vine, bunches of them probably up. And the one thing about picking them for that, we knew they weren't going for jam making. You didn't get worried if there were some green ones and some, you know, ones that were red, that weren't fully ripe, because that wasn't the case. I even had the people, unscrupulous young fellas, now we wouldn't do it where I was from, but I had the young fellas that actually put water into the buckets and they'd come to collect them, and of course, would weigh this heavy, then we wouldn't do that now. We'd be strictly honest.
You know, so it was buckets like, you collected them in? It was probably
plastic buckets, yeah. A sweet gallons from the shop. We get sweet gallons when the sweets just come in gallons at them, so rocks and bullseyes, and you get empty sweet gallons above the shop. And a sweet gallon full would nearly be a stone of blackberries, like, and we would store them then. And John Fitzgerald from Fermoy would come twice a week. He was collecting for cows and coloured glass, and nothing have 5 or 15 or 20 pounds made at the end of September. And that would keep you going in pocket money to Christmas, because when I was small, there was nothing with parents giving you pocket money.
£50.
Pocket money wasn't invented when we got into the EU, I'd say, like.
Right, but £50, so that's you're talking about four, you'd take 4 stone to the, would you have to pick 4 stone to get a pound's worth of, you have to pick 4 stone to get a pound's worth. And to get £50, you'd have to pick 200 stone of blackberries.
200 weight of them. Yeah, that's right, yeah. But I suppose, you know, long summer evenings at time other than going to matches, you wouldn't have all that to do with Saturday afternoon coming home from school and everything, you wouldn't have all that to do with that. We never considered it, and your fingers would be absolutely purple, and you wouldn't tell they wash them, so you needn't even wash them, because they'd be purple again the next day, that kind of way.
And did you eat any of them, or did you keep them all for selling?
You'd eat as much of them as you could, and then you'd stop eating them when you'd have enough of them. Right. I suppose, like picking strawberries, you can't eat so many, but I still pick them this year now. I suppose I'm after picking maybe 2 stone, but I didn't even get a chance to make jam yet this year. I just put them all in the freezer at the moment, but someday soon I will make jam. But as well as blackberries, then you'd pick rose hips, and I'd pick sloes as well, and mix them all together. But I suppose you were talking a while ago, but would you want quality or quantity? If you're making jelly, blackberry jellies, you needn't be worried.
What do you...
much, because you'd
What do you do at rose hips, John, as a matter of interest? Because the only thing we ever used them for was to break open and get the white stuff inside and put them down each other's backs. Powder.
No, it's the rose hip setup. Obviously, it's great for providing, I think, because vitamin C. But what we would do with rose hips is, if you had a pound of rose hips, throw them into the blackberries from the point of view of making, you wouldn't make jam out of them, then you make jelly, just boil up the whole lot together, sieve it through a muslin bag overnight and boil them up with sugar the following day and pass it, and you'd have kind of, as you call it, an autumn jelly. You could put elderberries, flowers, blackberries, and rose hips all in together, and to be the juice of them, you'd be making the jelly out of them. I think the lid would be last year. Now, I didn't make that much with it. I think I only made 25 pounds of jams all I made last year. But I'd say I have enough blackberries in the freezer this year to make maybe not twice that much, but as much again anyhow. Would you save enough of the money by the time you have the sugar bought? But since the fact that it's off your own brambles, off your own broils that you buy, it's nice to have something kind of local and homegrown, you know, that kind of way, you know.
All right, you heard it there, John, and before that, Aideen, grab your buckets and hit the hedges while the blackberries are still ripe. We'll take a break, back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, the multiple Oscar winner Maggie Smith, whose death we just learned about this afternoon, her sons Chris Larkin and Toby Stevens said she died on hospital early this morning, and they issued a statement via their publicist saying, "It's with great sadness we have to announce the death of Dame Maggie Smith. She passed away peacefully in hospital early this morning, Friday the 27th of September. An intensely private person, she was with friends and family at the end. She leaves two sons and five loving grandchildren who are devastated by the loss of their extraordinary mother and grandmother. We'd like to take the opportunity to thank the wonderful staff at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital for their care and unstinting kindness during their final days." And they also thank people for their kind messages of support, but ask that their privacy be respected. And for anyone who doesn't remember the Oscars that Maggie Smith won, she got Best Actress Award for The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie in 1969 and Best Supporting Actress for California Suite in 1978. And she was also nominated for Othello in 1965, Travels with My Aunt in 1972, and A Room with a View in 1985, and also Gosford Park in 2001. So that's a hell of a career behind her, and sad news, as I say, of that coming in this morning, of her death coming in this morning. Now, James Sexton, you're contemplating your ultimate end, but you're nowhere near it at the moment. Why?
Hello, Colm. Hi, nice to talk to you. I am. Yeah, I actually feel a little bit embarrassed, Colm, actually raising this issue, given your first caller and what they are have had to endure. Myself and my wife were both in our mid-50s, and we have been giving some thought to our wills, and we feel that we're being discriminated against as we don't have children, and we believe that this discrimination also applies to single people without children.
Right, but you do want children to be the beneficiaries of your will, but they'll be disadvantaged because of your relationship to them.
That's exactly it. As it exists at the present time, the current tax thresholds, the inheritance tax thresholds, are divided into three separate categories, Group A, B and C. And Group A means that a child can inherit tax-free a whopping $335,000 from their parents. In Group B, a brother, a sister, a nephew or a niece can inherit up to $32,500 tax-free. And in Group C, all others could inherit tax-free up to $16,250. Now, in our circumstances, we have a number of nephews and nieces, and I have brothers. But the maximum amount of inheritance that each could receive tax-free at present is $32,500. But if we had children, our children would be able to inherit up to, as I say, $335,000 tax-free. And
you would have to pick a favourite if you wanted to go outside of that. I mean, in your case, you want to do an equal division between nieces and nephews. But for the purpose of a relief, one of your nephews or nieces could qualify as a favourite nephew or niece, and get the category A tax treatment of €335,000, but you'd have to pick one of them.
I think that's only the case if it's for if I was passing on business assets. Now, I'm actually a teacher. I run a small after-school education
You're
centre.
You're right, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, in Cork, helping students, primary school students with maths, English and Irish. But, you know, and my wife is an accountant, so we would not be able to pass on anything like that. You know, we do not have any business assets. We don't run a business as such in that respect. But we just feel that we should be able to pass on the same amount of monetary assets to our family members as would be the case if we had children. I think very often when this debate comes up, there's a kind of a misconception that this tax only applies to the super rich in this country. But in reality, any couple or single person who doesn't have children and whose perhaps only asset is their house that they've worked so hard for during their lifetime will be affected. And, you know, those people don't consider themselves to be wealthy. They just simply have an asset which they would like to pass on to their loved ones when they're deceased.
Right. And I suppose for people who aren't familiar with it, the sum of $32,500 that your niece or nephew can inherit, yeah, that also includes gifts during their lifetime. So it's not like you have the opportunity now to pass that on to them or even incrementally pass it on to them. It's the total gifts up to the value of $32,500 over their lifetime and whatever they inherit afterwards.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, we know it's obviously so difficult for young people today to be able to actually even afford a home. And, you know, myself and my wife have worked hard and we're not super rich, but we would like to be able to, you know, if we have some money left that when we pass away, that we would like to have the opportunity to pass our assets on to our loved ones in the same way that other parents can pass their assets to their children. And I think, unfortunately, so many couples and single people do not seem to be aware of this. And I think it's only upon their passing that their loved ones will actually realise that how unfairly they're being treated by the state when they actually have to pay a very significant inheritance tax bill.
I mean, you sound frustrated, James. Have you contacted public representatives to flag this with them, or what kind of a response have you got?
I did, yeah. I actually, you know, over the last number of months, I would have written to all political parties of you know, and I got very, very little response back. Most were telling me what I already knew and explaining the inheritance tax procedures, but no politician was able to give a personal opinion and to explain to me why perhaps some politicians would, you know, if they have children, why they can pass on a considerably greater amount of assets to their children than obviously that what I or my wife can do to our loved ones.
Yeah, and you're probably aware of the debate that's going on within the coalition parties of increasing the threshold from 335 to 400,000. Would even a revision of the 32,500 limit on Category B do anything to alleviate your concerns, or is it the principle of what you feel is discrimination that's really your main point of concern?
Yeah, I think it is the principle, and obviously even if that threshold does go up, that obviously is going to benefit parents and their children, but that's not going to help myself. I can't imagine the threshold B level is going to go up very significantly from 32,500. I know there's an argument that was, you know, one of the politicians made to me was that obviously if they were to increase the threshold B in line with the threshold A, that it would cost the Exchequer a huge sum of money. I think that they mentioned something like 248 million. But my argument would be that, well, why don't we reduce the threshold A down to 32,500 and save the state perhaps the same amount and put that money towards improvements in public services to improve the services for that first caller and her family at the start of your programme.
Yeah, that was Michelle, for anyone who didn't catch the top of the programme. That was Michelle and the situation she's in as a result of a bus service being unavailable to her family. James, thanks very much for contacting us about it.
Yeah, well, hopefully, we'll see in the budget next week now what happens, but maybe it might be something that other callers might have some comments on. I'd be very interested. Yeah.
All right. Thaddeus O'Sullivan, good afternoon to you.
Oh, hello. How are you?
You're a filmmaker. You've worked. You worked in the past with Maggie Smith. What did you make of the news that came out today that she passed away in the company of her family this morning?
Well, I was very sad to hear it. It was so wonderful to work with her. Having seen her work over the years, it was really quite a privilege to be talking to her. Never mind working with her. So I was very sad to hear that.
Right. What was she like?
She was, I found her very easy to deal with. She had a reputation for being difficult, but it wasn't really that. It was just that she was very particular,
right,
I would say. And at the outset, I certainly was in awe of her and perhaps held back a bit. She spotted that. She could see that there was, pussyfooting around her a little bit. So she drew my attention to that, and we had a conversation about it.
Right.
After which, everything was, I was able to talk to her in a much more, be much more firm about the sort of things that I wanted. And she was quite comfortable with that. So we got into a rhythm after a while, which I guess with every actor, it's different. And with her, it was finding the right way to speak to each other. But she was an extraordinary worker at that age, when you consider, I think she was 87 when we did it. And
sorry, the project you're talking about is The Miracle Club. It was
The Miracle Club, sorry.
Yeah, a film about people who go, four women who go on a pilgrimage from Dublin to Lourdes.
Yes, and she was one of the four women. She was, she worked very long. She worked the hours that we worked, and that was, those days are quite long. And she never complained about anything, really.
And was she kind of cast for that didn't suffer fools gladly demeanour she had? I mean, you knew her sort of by reputation, but did that add to the casting? Yeah. There was a sort of a formidable edge to her, which obviously fans of Downton Abbey saw, but that was true to her in life, and she could act it also.
Yes, I think that in the character in our story, there definitely was some of that, a slightly matriarchal position that she held in the community, she was able to express pretty effortlessly.
Right. Somebody able to speak her mind.
Of course, able to speak her mind and able to, put people in the right direction as far as she was concerned. It was more complex, of course, than that. She was harboring a lot of guilt in the story, so there was a depth to the performance that was very impressive, as you'd expect.
Right. You had quite the cast for that, apart from Maggie Smith, Kathy Bates, who people would know from Misery, which I think she won an Oscar for as well, Laura Linney, who people would know from Ozark, and Agnes O'Casey from Dangerous Liaisons. I mean, it was quite the cast.
Yes, it was. And again, I was in awe of that grouping. But, once they settled into Dublin and got going, it was the professionalism just takes over, and they just there to do a job. It
right.
Never,
I suppose given the Marian theme of the program, "Blessed art thou amongst women," must have been what came into your head at the beginning of every day, was it?
Yeah, they all had a bit of Catholicism, somewhere in the back of their existence. To relations or themselves, or through an Irish connection, and so there was plenty of common ground. Lourdes was a great fascination for them.
All right, Marion, you're a fan.
Hello, good afternoon. Yes,
yeah.
I'm very sorry to hear about Maggie Smith's death. I didn't know she was ill or that, but I know she's pushing on in years. But I loved her. She was fabulous. Now, what I remember from most is the Marigold Hotels. I would have seen those programmes. There's a good few programmes, maybe five or six of them.
What was it that you liked about her? Was it that kind of stern matriarch with a bit of a humorous twinkle in her eye?
Yeah, that's it. And there were times in scenes that she didn't even have to speak. You knew as the viewer that the look was enough. Didn't have to open her mouth. I suppose she reminded me of somebody possibly in my life. I don't know, but I just loved her. I thought she was a fabulous lady. And anything she was on, I'd always make sure I watched it. If I could, you know. I didn't see Downton Abbey now because I was working, but there was another old one there she was in back, I don't know, was it in the 60s? They mentioned it, or it was mentioned there, but I can't remember the name.
The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie was one of the ones she won an Oscar for.
Oh, that one, yeah. That was very good. I think that was in black and white when I saw it. I don't know now, but it was probably made in black and white. But she was just fabulous. And the cast of the Marigold Hotel were fabulous as well. You had Miriam Margolyes, who's another actress I adore, and Judi Dench, another one I adore.
Right. And you haven't seen Downton Abbey, have you not?
Not yet.
Right.
No.
So are you going to
my bucket list?
Right. You're gonna. Have, well, would you think you'll be getting it out now that you've heard of Maggie Smith's passing?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I didn't see it because the way my work was at the time, and I wouldn't be there for the start of it, and I might be there the night it was on, and you know, because it just. It was shift work, so it wasn't easy to see those kind of programs. But I did see snippets from it here and there. But she would have been fabulous in that. I have no doubt.
All right. Any recommendations, Thaddeus? What would be a Maggie Smith highlight?
Pardon?
What would be a Maggie Smith highlight from your own point
Maggie
of view?
Smith highlight.
Apart from obviously the Miracle Club.
Private Miss Jean Brodie. The Private Miss Jean Brodie, I would say. Would be my favourite, Maggie Smith. As regards her expressions, you know, even off camera, you catch a look from Maggie that whether she likes or doesn't like something, it's very direct.
All right.
You are never in any doubt as to what she's thinking, and it doesn't take much, doesn't take many words to sort of make herself known what she feels.
Yeah, I think
She was also in the Young Cassidy, I remember, years ago.
Oh, that's the one that's based on Sean O'Casey, the old film. Yeah. Yeah, starring, what's his name, Rod?
And she played Dublin in that.
Okay. All right. Well, we have to take a short break. We're back in a moment. Thanks.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
That's our lot for today and indeed for this week on Sound, where Mark McGrath, broadcast coordinator, was Shane Galvin. Research was by Richie Byrne and the producer was Rachel Gray. And I'm Colm O'Mungain. I'm back on Monday. Ray Darcy's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Their new autumn range will leave you bursting with ideas. View in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.